When the episode was mercifully over, Nathan stood and placed the waste bin on the floor. He wiped his mouth with a tissue from the table and took a sip of water.
"Please tell me what's going on," he said in a scratchy voice.
"You're under arrest, Mr. Coley," Fremont said. "Customs violations, the importation of controlled substances, and possession of a firearm. Why did you think you could enter Jamaica with 4 kilos of pure cocaine and a handgun?"
Nathan's jaw dropped. His mouth opened, but nothing escaped but warm air. He squinted, frowned, pleaded with his eyes, and tried again to speak. Nothing. Finally, he managed a feeble,
"What?"
"Don't play dumb, Mr. Coley. Where were you going? Off to one of our famous resorts for a week of drugs and sex? Was it all for personal consumption, or did you intend to sell some of it to other rich Americans?"
"This is a joke, right? Where's Reed? The fun's over. Ha ha. Now get me out of here."
Fremont reached for his thick belt and removed a set of handcuffs. "Turn around, sir. Hands behind your back." Nathan suddenly yelled,
"Reed! I know you're out there. Stop laughing, asshole, and tell these clowns to knock it off."
"Turn around, sir,"
Fremont said again. But Nathan did not comply. Instead, he yelled even louder,
"Reed! I'll get you for this. Nice joke. I hear you laughing out there."
The other two officers stepped forward, and each took an arm. Nathan wisely realized that resisting would not work. When the handcuffs were in place, they led him from the room and into the hallway. Nathan spun around wildly, looking for Reed or anyone else who might step forward and put an end to this. They walked past rooms with open doors, small rooms with 2 and 3 beds practically touching each other. They walked past comatose patients on gurneys parked against the walls, and nurses writing in charts, and orderlies watching television. "Everyone is black," Nathan noticed. "I really am in Jamaica." They shuffled down a set of stairs and through an exit door. When he stepped into the thick air and brilliant sun, Nathan knew he was on foreign soil and unfriendly territory. A cab takes Vanessa back to the airport where she'll catch a 9:40 flight to Atlanta. She is scheduled to arrive in Roanoke this evening at 6:50. She will drive to Radford and check into a motel. I will not be joining her for a few days. I take another cab to the downtown area of Montego Bay. Unlike Kingston, the capital, which is 300 years old, Montego Bay is a new city that developed as resorts, hotels, condos, and shopping villages sprawled inward, away from the ocean, and finally met up with the neighborhoods. There is no main avenue or central plaza or stately courthouse in the center of town. Government buildings are scattered over a wide area, as are most of the professional buildings. My driver finds the law office of Mr. Rashford Watley. I pay the fare and hustle up a flight of stairs to a landing where a bunch of lawyers keep small, separate offices. Mr. Watley explained on the phone that he rarely works on Saturdays, but he'll make an exception for me. His ad in the Yellow Pages boasts of 30 years' experience in all criminal courts. When we shake hands, I can tell he's pleasantly surprised to see that I, too, am black. He probably assumed that as an American tourist, I was like all the rest. We take our seats in his modest office, and after a few pleasantries, I get to the point. Sort of. He suggests that we dispense with the formalities and use first names only. So it's Reed and Rashford. I quickly go through the narrative about my background as a filmmaker,
my current project involving one Nathan Coley, and so on. But before long, I'm veering off course. I tell Rashford that Nathan and I came to Jamaica for a few days of fun. He got drunk and blacked out on the airplane, causing a medical emergency upon our arrival. I'm not sure, but I think he tried to smuggle in some drugs and was packing a gun. I managed to get away last night in the confusion, so I wish to retain Rashford for two purposes. First, and most important, to represent me and protect me from whatever hot water I might be in. Second, to make some calls and pull some strings to find out about Nathan and the charges against him. I want Rashford to visit Nathan in jail and assure him I'm doing all I can to secure his release. No problem, Rashford assures me. We agree on a fee, and I pay him in cash. He immediately gets on the phone and checks with contacts in customs and the police. I can't tell if he's hamming it up for me, but the guy knows a lot of people. After an hour, I excuse myself and walk down the street for a soft drink. When I return to his office, Rashford is still on the phone, scribbling away on a notepad. I'm reading a magazine in the lobby under a noisy ceiling fan when Rashford appears and sits on his secretary's desk. Things are grim, and he's shaking his head.
Your friend is in big trouble, he says. First, he tried to enter with a bogus passport.
No kidding, Rash. I listen intently.
Did you know this? He asks.
Of course not, I reply. I assume Rashford has never chartered a private jet and therefore does not know the routine.
But much worse, he continues. He tried to smuggle in a handgun and 4 kilos of cocaine.
4 kilos of cocaine? I repeat, acting as shocked as possible.
Found the powder in 2 nylon first aid kits in his gym bag, along with a small pistol. What a fool.
I'm shaking my head in disbelief. He mentioned buying drugs once he got here, but said nothing about smuggling the stuff in.
How well do you know this gentleman?
Rashford asks. I just met him a week ago. We're not exactly close friends. I know he has a history of drug violations in the States, but I had no idea he was an idiot.
Well, he is, and he'll probably be spending the next 20 years in one of our fine prisons.
20?
5 for the coke, 15 for the gun.
That's outrageous. You gotta do something, Rashford.
The options are limited, but allow me to go about my business.
What about me? Am I okay down here? I mean, they checked my bags at customs and everything was cool. I'm not an accomplice or guilty by association, right?
As of now, nothing. But I suggest you leave as soon as possible.
I can't leave until I see Nathan. I mean, I gotta help this guy, you know?
There's not much you can do, Reed. They found the coke and the gun in his bag.
I start pacing around the small room, deep in thought, worried sick. Rashford watches me for a moment, then says,
They'll probably allow me to see Mr. Coley. I know the boys at the jail. See them all the time. You've hired the right lawyer, Reed, but again, I'm not sure what can be done.
How often do you see this? American tourists busted for drugs down here. He thinks about this, then says,
Happens all the time, but not like this. The Americans get caught on the way out, not bringing the stuff in. It's rather unusual, but the drug charges are not that crucial. We're soft on drugs, but hard on guns. We have very tough laws, especially with handguns. What was this boy thinking?
I don't know.
Allow me to go see him and make contact.
I need to see him too, Rashford. You gotta work this out. Lean on your friends at the jail and talk them into it. It might take some cash. How much? He shrugs and says, not much. $20 US. I got that. Allow me to see what I can do. Chapter 35. The pilots are calling my cell phone, but I refuse to answer. Devin leaves 4 frantic voicemails, all pretty much the same. The police have seized the airplane and the pilots have been told they cannot leave the island. They are staying at the Hilton, but not having any fun. Their office in Raleigh is screaming, and everybody wants answers. The pilots are taking the heat for submitting a fake passport and will probably lose their jobs. The airplane's owner is threatening, and so on. I don't have the time to worry about these people. I'm sure a man who owns a $30 million jet can figure out a way to get it back. At 2 p.m., Rashford and I leave his office, and he drives us 10 minutes to the police department. The city jail is attached to it. He parks in a crowded lot and nods at a low-slung, flat-roofed building with narrow slits for windows and razor wire for decoration. We walk down a sidewalk, and Rashford says a pleasant hello to the guards and orderlies. He goes to a door and whispers with a guard he obviously knows. I watch without being obvious, and no cash changes hands. At a desk, we sign a sheet on a clipboard.
I told them you're a lawyer working with me,
he whispers as I scribble one of my names.
Just act like a lawyer.
If he only knew. Rashford waits in a long, narrow room the lawyers use for meetings if the police are not using it for anything else. There is no air conditioning and the room feels like a sauna. After a few minutes, the door opens and Nathan Coley is shoved inside. He looks wild-eyed at Rashford, then turns to his guard, who leaves and closes the door. Nathan slowly sits down on a metal stool and gawks at Rashford. The lawyer thrusts a business card at him and says,
I'm Rashford Whatley, attorney. Your friend, Reed Baldwin, has hired me to look into this situation.
Nathan takes the card and inches the stool closer. His left eye is partially closed, and his left jaw is swollen. There is dried blood at the corner of his lips.
Where's Reed?
He asks.
He's here. He is very concerned and wants to see you. Are you okay, Mr. Coley? Your jaw is swollen.
Nathan looks at the large, round, black face and tries to absorb the words. It's English, all right, but with a strange accent. He wants to correct this guy and explain that it's Cooley, not Coley. But then maybe the guy is trying to say Cooley, but it just comes out differently in Jamaica.
Are you all right, Mr. Coley?
The lawyer repeats.
I've had 2 fights in the past 2 hours. Lost both of them. You gotta get me out of here, mister.
He looks at the card but can't focus on the words.
It's Whatley. Mr. Whatley. Fine, Mr. Whatley. This is a big misunderstanding. I don't know what happened, what went wrong, but I ain't guilty of anything. I didn't use a fake passport, and I damn sure didn't try to smuggle in drugs and a gun. Somebody planted that stuff in my bag. You got that? That's the truth. And I swear on a stack of Bibles. I don't use drugs, don't sell them, and I damn sure don't smuggle them. I want to talk to Reed.
He sort of spits his words through clenched teeth and rubs his jaw as he talks.
Is your jaw broken?
Rashford asks.
I ain't no doctor. I'll try to get one, and I'll try to get you moved to another cell. They're all the same, hot, overcrowded, and dirty.
You gotta do something, Mr. Whatley. And fast. I'll never survive in here.
You've been in prison before, I think.
I just spent a few years in a federal pen, but nothing like this. I just thought that was bad. This is pure hell. I got 15 guys in my cell, all black but me, with two beds and a hole in the corner to piss in. No air conditioning and no food. Please, Mr. Whatley, do something.
You're facing very serious charges, Mr. Corley. If convicted, as charged, you could be sentenced to 20 years in prison.
Nathan drops his head and takes a deep breath.
I won't last a week.
I'm confident I can get a reduction, but still, you're facing a lot of time. And not in a city jail like this. They'll send you away to one of our regional prisons, where the conditions are not always as pleasant.
Then give me a plan. You've got to explain to the judge or whoever that this is all a mistake. I'm not guilty, okay? You gotta make somebody believe that.
I'll try, Mr. Corley, but the system has to run its course. And unfortunately, things move rather slowly here in Jamaica. The court will schedule your first appearance in a few days. The informal charges will be handed down.
What about bail? Can I post a bond and get out of here?
I'm working on that now with a bail bondsman. But I'm not optimistic. The court would consider you a flight risk. How much money is at your disposal?
Nathan snorts and shakes his head.
I don't know. I had $1,000 in my wallet. Wherever it happens to be now. I'm sure the money's gone. I had $500 in my pocket, too, and it's gone. They've picked me clean. I got a few assets back home, but nothing liquid. I'm not a rich man, Mr. Whatley. I'm a 30-year-old ex-con who was in prison about 6 months ago. My family has nothing.
Well, the court will look at the amount of cocaine and a private jet, and think otherwise.
The cocaine is not mine. I never saw it, never touched it. It was planted, okay, Mr. Whatley? So was the gun.
I believe you, Mr. Corley, but the court will likely be more skeptical. The court hears such stories all the time.
Nathan opened his mouth slowly and picked at the dried blood at the corner of his lips. He was obviously in pain and shock. Rashford stood and said,
"Keep your seat. Reads here. If anyone asks, tell them he's just one of your lawyers."
Nathan's battered face lights up somewhat when I enter. I sit on my stool, less than 3 feet from him. He wants to yell, but he knows someone is listening.
What the hell is happening here, Reed? Talk to me.
My act at this point is that of a frightened man who is not sure what will happen tomorrow.
I don't know, Nathan, I say nervously.
I'm not under arrest, but I can't leave the island. I found Rashford Whatley first thing this morning, and we're trying to figure it all out. All I remember is that we got real drunk real fast.
Stupid.
Got that. You passed out on the sofa, and I was barely awake. At some point, one of the pilots called me up to the cockpit and explained that air traffic around Miami was grounded because of weather. Tornado warnings. A tropical storm. Really bad stuff. Miami International was closed. The system was moving north, so we circled to the south and were diverted over the Caribbean. We circled and circled, and I really can't remember all of what happened. I tried to wake you, but you were snoring.
I don't remember blacking out,
he says, tapping his sore jaw. Does a drunk ever remember passing out? No, he does not. You were bombed, okay? You had been drinking before we took off. Anyway, at some point we were getting low on fuel and had to land. According to the pilots, we were directed here,
to Montego Bay to refuel. Then we were supposed to leave for Miami, where the weather had cleared. I'm drinking coffee by the gallon, and so I remember most of what happened. When we land, the captain says just stay on the plane. We'll only be here for 20 minutes. Then he says that Immigration and Customs want to take a look. We're ordered off the plane, but you're in a coma and can't move. You barely have a pulse. They call an ambulance, and everything starts going wrong. What's this shit about a fake passport? My mistake. We fly into Miami International all the time, and they often want to see a passport, even for domestic flights, especially private ones. I think it goes back to the drug wars in the 1980s when a lot of private jets were used to haul drug lords and their entourages. Now, with the war on terror, they like to see a passport. It's not mandatory to have one, but it's very helpful. I got a guy in D.C. who can produce one overnight for $100, and I asked him to crank one out for you, just in case we needed it. I had no idea it would become an issue. Poor Nathan does not know what to believe. I have the benefit of months of preparation. He's getting hit fast and furious and is thoroughly bewildered. Believe me, Nathan, a fake passport is the least of your worries. Where'd the coke and the gun come from? He asks. The police, I say casually but with certainty. It wasn't you, and it wasn't me, so that narrows the list of suspects. Rashford says this is not unheard of on the island. A private jet from America arrives with a couple of rich guys on board. Rich, otherwise they wouldn't be buzzing around on such a fine airplane. One of the rich dudes is so drunk he can't hit his ass with both hands. Blacked out drunk. They get the sober guy off the plane and get the pilots distracted with paperwork, and when the timing is perfect, they plant the drugs. Stuff it in a bag. Just that simple. A few hours later, the jet is officially seized by the Jamaican government, and the trafficker is placed under arrest. It's all about money. Cash. Nathan is absorbing this as he stares at his bare feet. His pink and orange Hawaiian shirt has bloodstains on it. There are scratches on his arms and hands. Can you get me something to eat, Reed? I'm starving. They served lunch an hour ago. Shit's so nasty you can't imagine. And before I could take a bite, one of my cellies decided he needed it more than me. I say, sorry, Nathan. I'll see if Rashford can bribe one of the guards. He mumbles, please. Do you want me to call someone back home? I ask. He shakes his head no. Who? The only person I halfway trust is the guy who runs my bar. And I think he's stealing. I'm cut off from my family, and they wouldn't help anyway. How can they? They don't know where Jamaica is. Not sure I can find it on the map. Rashford thinks they might charge me as an accomplice, so I might be joining you back there. He shakes his head. You might survive because you're black and you're in good shape. A skinny white boy ain't got a chance. As soon as I walked into the cell, this big dude says he really likes my Nikes. Gone. Next guy wants to borrow some money, and since I don't have any money, he wants me to promise to get some real soon. This leads to the first fight, which involved at least three of these thugs beating the shit out of me. I remember hearing a guard laugh and saying something about a white boy who can't fight too good. My spot on the concrete floor is right next to the toilet, which is nothing but an open hole like an outhouse. The smell will make you gag and puke. If I move an inch or two, then I'm on somebody else's turf and there's a fight. There's no air conditioning, and it's like an oven. 15 men in a tight space, all sweating and hungry and thirsty, and no one can sleep. I cannot imagine what tonight will be like. Please, Reed, get me out of here. I'll try, Nathan. But there's a good chance these guys might try to nail me, too.
Just do something. Please.
Look, Nathan. This is all my fault, okay? That means nothing at this point. But I had no way of knowing we were flying into a storm. The stupid pilots should have told us about the weather before we took off. Or they should have landed somewhere on U.S. soil. Or they should have had more fuel on the airplane. We'll sue the bastards when we get home, okay?
Whatever.
Nathan, I'll do anything I can to get you out of here. But my ass is still on the line, too. It's gonna come down to money. This is nothing but a shakedown, a grab for money by a bunch of cops who know how to play the game. Hell, they wrote the rules. Rashford says they'll squeeze the owner of the jet and pocket a handsome bribe. They'll throw a bone our way and see how much cash we can scrape together. Now that they know we have a lawyer, he thinks they'll contact him pretty soon. They prefer to work their little bribery schemes before the case gets into court. After that, you got formal charges and judges watching everything. You understand all this, Nathan?
I guess. I just can't believe this, Reed. This time yesterday, I was at my bar having a beer with a cute girl, bragging about flying to Miami for the weekend. Now look at me, thrown into a filthy jail cell with a bunch of Jamaicans, and they're all lined up waiting to kick my ass. You're right, Reed. This is all your fault. You and your ridiculous movie. I should have never listened to you.
I'm sorry, Nathan. Believe me, I'm so sorry.
You should be. Just do something, Reed, and hurry. I can't last much longer back there.
Chapter 36. Rashford gives me a ride to my hotel and, at the last minute, graciously extends an invitation to dinner. He says his wife is an excellent cook, and they would be delighted to have such an accomplished filmmaker in their home. Though I am tempted, primarily because I have nothing to do for the next 18 hours, I beg off with the lame excuse of feeling bad and needing sleep. I'm living a lie, and the last thing I need is a long dinner conversation about my life, my work, and my past. I suspect there will be serious people following my trail, sniffing for clues, and a stray word here or there could come back to haunt me. It's July. The tourist season is over, and the hotel is not busy. There's a small pool with a bar in the shade, and I spend the afternoon under an umbrella, reading a Walter Mosley and sipping Red Stripe beer. Vanessa lands in Roanoke at 7 o'clock Saturday evening. She is exhausted, but rest is not an option. In the past 48 hours, she has driven from Radford to D.C. to Roanoke and flown from Roanoke to Jamaica and back by way of Charlotte, Atlanta, and Miami. Other than a fitful 3-hour rest in bed in Montego Bay and several catnaps on airplanes, she has had no sleep. She leaves the terminal with her small carry-on bag and takes her time finding her car. As always, she notices everything and everyone around her. We doubt if she's being followed, but at this point in our project, we take nothing for granted. She drives across the highway from the airport and gets a room at a Holiday Inn. She orders room service and eats dinner at the window as the sun goes down. At 10 p.m., she calls me and we speak briefly and in code. We're on our third or fourth prepaid cell phone, and it's highly unlikely anyone is listening, but, again, we're taking no chances. I conclude with a simple, proceed as planned. She drives back to the airport, to the General Aviation Terminal, and parks next to Nathan's pickup truck. It's late on a Saturday night and there is no private air traffic, no movements in the empty parking lot.
She puts on a pair of thin leather gloves and, using Nathan's keys, unlocks his door and drives away. It's Vanessa's first drive in such a vehicle, and she takes it easy. Not far down the road, she pulls into a fast food parking lot and adjusts the seat and mirrors. For the past 5 years, she's been driving a small Japanese model, and the upgrade is astounding and uncomfortable. The last thing we can afford is a fender bender or a set of flashing blue lights. Eventually, she makes it onto Interstate 81 and heads south, toward Radford, Virginia. It's almost midnight when she leaves the state highway and turns onto the country lane to Nathan's house. She passes the double-wide trailer, home to Nathan's nearest neighbor, at 15 miles per hour, making virtually no noise. In her own car, she's driven this road a dozen times and knows the terrain. The road winds past Nathan's and through some pasture land before passing another home, almost 2 miles farther into the country. Beyond that, the asphalt fades into gravel, then to dirt. There is no traffic because there is so little population. It seems odd that a 30-year-old bachelor would choose such a secluded place to live. She parks in his driveway and listens. Nathan's yellow lab is in the backyard, in the distance, barking inside a large, fenced-in dog run with a cute little house to keep him dry. Other than the dog, though, there are no sounds. The darkness is broken slightly by a small yellow porch light. Vanessa has a 9mm Glock stuck in a pocket, and she thinks she knows how to use it. She walks around the house, careful where she steps, listening to everything. The dog barks louder, but no one other than Vanessa can hear him. At the rear door, she starts using the keys. The first three fit neither the locked knob nor the deadbolt, but numbers 4 and 5 do the trick. She takes a breath as she pushes the door open. There are no sirens, no frantic beepings. She had walked through the same door just 5 days earlier during the first session of filming and noticed the deadbolts and the absence of an alarm system. Once inside, Vanessa peels off the leather gloves and puts on a pair of disposable latex gloves. She is about to examine every inch of the house, and she cannot leave a single print. Walking quickly, she flips on lights, pulls down all the shades, and cranks up the air conditioning. It's a cheap rental house being leased by an unmarried hillbilly who's spent the last 5 years in prison, so the decor and furnishings are sparse. There are a few sticks of furniture, the obligatory oversized television, and sheets on some of the windows. There are also dirty dishes stacked by the kitchen sink and dirty clothes on the bathroom floor. The guest bedroom is used to store junk. 2 dead mice lay perfectly still in traps, their necks snapped in two. She begins in Nathan's bedroom by going through a tall chest of drawers. Nothing. She looks under his bed and between the mattress and the box spring. She examines every inch of his cluttered closet. The house has a conventional framed foundation, no concrete slab, and the hardwood flooring gives way slightly with each step. She taps the flooring, searching for a more hollow sound, for evidence of a hiding place. I suspect Nathan has hidden his loot somewhere in the house, though probably not in one of the main rooms. Nonetheless, we have to look everywhere. If he's smart, which is a stretch, he has split it and is using more than one hiding place. From his bedroom, Vanessa inspects the guest room, giving the dead mice plenty of space. At 12:30, she begins turning off lights, as if Nathan is winding down. Room by room she goes, checking every corner, every plank, every pocket. Nothing goes unturned or untested. It could be in the walls, the floors, the drywall above the ceilings, or it could be buried in the backyard or stashed in a safe at Bombay's. The cramped basement has 7-foot ceilings, no air conditioning, and unpainted cinder block walls. After spending an hour there, Vanessa is soaking wet and too tired to go on. At 2 a.m., she stretches out on the sofa in the den and falls asleep with her hand on the Glock's holster. If Rashford was hesitant to work on Saturday, he was almost belligerent on Sunday, but I gave him little choice. I pleaded with him to accompany me to the jail and pull the same strings he'd pulled the day before. I gave him a $100 bill to facilitate matters. We arrive at the jail just before 9 a.m., and 15 minutes later, I am alone with Nathan in the same room used yesterday. I am shocked at his appearance. His injuries are evident and substantial, and I wonder how long the guards will allow the abuse to continue. His face is a mess of gashes, open wounds, and dried blood. His upper lip is bloated and protrudes grotesquely from under his nose. His left eye is completely shut, and his right one is red and puffy. He is missing one front tooth. Gone are the cutoffs and cute Hawaiian shirt, replaced by a dirt-stained white jumpsuit covered with dried blood. We both lean forward, our faces just inches apart.
"Help me,"
he manages to say, almost in tears. "Here's the latest, Nathan," I begin. "The crooks are demanding $1 million from the Jets owner, and he's agreed to pay it, so these scumbags will get their money. They're not going to charge me with anything, as of this morning. For you, they want $500,000. I've explained, through Rashford, that neither of us has that kind of money. I've explained that we were just passengers on someone's jet, that we're not rich, and so on. The Jamaicans don't believe this. Anyway, that's where we are as of right now." Nathan grimaces, as if it hurts to breathe. As bad as his face looks, I'd hate to see the rest of his body. I'm imagining the worst, so I don't ask what happened. He grunts and says,
"Can you get back to the U.S., Reed?"
His voice is weak and scratchy. Even it is wounded. "I think so. Rashford thinks so. But I don't have a lot of cash, Nathan." He frowns and grunts again, and looks as though he may either faint or cry.
"Reed, listen to me. I have some money. A lot of it."
I'm staring him straight in the eyes, or at least his right one because his left one is closed. This is the fateful moment upon which everything else has been created. Without this, the entire project would be a gargantuan disaster, one horrific and lousy gamble. "How much?" I ask as he pauses. He does not want to go on, but he has no choice.
"Enough to get me out."
"A $500,000, Nathan?"
"That and more. We need to be partners, Reed. Just me and you. I'll tell you where the money is. You go get it. You get me out of here, and we'll be partners. But you gotta give me your word, Reed. I have to trust you, okay?"
"Hang on, Nathan," I say, pulling back and throwing up both palms. "You expect me to leave here, go home, then come back with a sack full of money and bribe the Jamaican police? Are you serious?"
"Please, Reed. There's no one else. I can't call anyone at home. No one there understands what's happening here. Only you. You gotta do it, Reed. Please? My life depends on it. I can't survive here. Look at me.
Please, Reed. You do what I ask, get me out, and you'll be a rich man.
I back away some more as if he's contagious. He's begging.
Come on, Reed. You got me into this mess. Now get me out.
It might be helpful if you explain how you made so much money.
I didn't make it. I stole it.
No surprise there. Drug money? I ask, but I know the answer.
No, no, no.
Are we partners, Reed? I don't know, Nathan. I'm not so sure I want to start bribing Jamaican police. What if I get busted? I could end up just like you.
Then don't come back. Send the money to Rashford. Get him to make the delivery. You can figure it out, Reed. Hell, you're a smart man.
I nod as if I like the way he's thinking. Where's the money, Nathan?
Are we partners, Reed? 50-50? Just me and you, man?
Okay. Okay. But I'm not risking jail over this, you understand?
I got it.
There's a pause as we study each other. His breathing is labored, and every word is painful. Slowly, he extends his right hand. It's puffy and scratched.
Partners, Reed?
He asks, pleading. Slowly, I shake his hand and he grimaces. It's probably broken. Where's the money? I ask.
It's at my house,
he says slowly, reluctantly, as he gives away the most precious secret of his life.
You've been there. There's a storage shed in the backyard, full of junk. It has a wooden floor, and to the right, under an old Sears pushmore that doesn't work, is a trapdoor. You can't see it until you move the mower and some of the junk around it. Watch out for snakes. There are a couple of king snakes that live there. Open the trapdoor, and you'll see a bronze casket.
His breathing is labored, and he is sweating profusely. The physical pain is obvious, but he's also tormented by the pain of such a momentous revelation.
A casket? I ask, incredulous. Yes, a child's casket. Closed and sealed, waterproof and airtight. There's a hidden latch at the narrow end where the feet would go. When you lift it, the seals release and you can open the casket.
What's inside?
A bunch of cigar boxes wrapped in duct tape. I think there are 18 of them.
You hid cash in cigar boxes?
It's not cash, Reed,
he says as he leans closer.
It's gold.
I appear too dumbfounded to speak, so he continues, almost in a whisper.
Mini bars, each weighing 10 ounces, as pure as anything being mined in the world. They're about the size of a large domino. They're beautiful, Reed. Just beautiful.
I stare at him for a long time in disbelief, then say, okay, as hard as it is, I'll resist asking a lot of obvious questions. I'm supposed to hustle home, go fetch the gold from a casket, fight off some snakes, somehow find a dealer who'll swap me gold for cash, and then figure out a way to smuggle $500,000 back here into Jamaica, where I'll fork it over to some crooked customs agents and police who will then set you free. That pretty well sum it up, Nathan.
It does. And hurry, okay?
I think you're crazy.
We shook hands. We're partners, Reed. You figure out a way to do it, and you'll be a rich man.
How many dominoes are we talking about?
Between 500 and 600.
What's gold worth these days?
2 days ago, it was trading for $1,500 an ounce.
I do the math and say, that's between 7.5 and 8 million bucks. Nathan is nodding. He does the math every day of his life as he watches the price fluctuate. There was a loud knock on the door behind me, and one of the jailers appears.
Time's up, man, he says, then disappears.
This is probably one of the stupidest things I'll ever do in my life, I say.
Or maybe one of the smartest,
Nathan replies.
But please hurry, Reed. I can't survive long.
We shake hands and say goodbye. My last visual of Nathan is a battered little man trying to stand, in pain. Rashford and I leave in a hurry. He drops me off at my hotel, where I run to my room and call Vanessa. She's in the attic where it's 120 degrees, picking through old cardboard boxes and broken furniture. It's not there, I announce. It's outside, in the storage shed.
Hang on,
she says, as she climbs down the retractable ladder.
Has he told you?
She asks between breaths. Yes.
Someone's here, she says.
And through the phone, I hear a loud doorbell chime. Vanessa ducks low in the hallway and reaches for the Glock.
I'll call you right back,
she whispers into the phone and turns it off. It's late Sunday morning. Nathan's truck is in his driveway. Assuming his friends would know he was away for the weekend, the presence of his truck would raise questions. The doorbell chimes again, and someone starts pounding on the front door. Then he yells,
Nathan, you in there? Open up!
Vanessa crouches but doesn't move. The banging continues. Then someone else is knocking on the back door and yelling for Nathan. There are at least two of them, with voices of young men, no doubt friends of Nathan's who stop by for some reason. They show no signs of leaving. One of them taps on his bedroom window, but he cannot see inside. Vanessa eases into the bathroom and wipes her face. Her breathing is heavy, and she's shaking with fear. They're pounding and yelling and will soon come to the conclusion that something is wrong with Nathan. They'll kick in a door. Instinctively, Vanessa strips down to her bikini panties, dries the sweat off her body, leaves the Glock near the bathroom sink, and steps to the front door. She opens it widely and the young man gets a most unexpected treat. Her brown breasts are large and firm, her body athletic and toned. His eyes drop from her chest to the panties, pinched together to reveal as much flesh as possible. Then he catches himself. She's smiling and saying,
Maybe Nathan is busy right now.
Wow, he says. Sorry.
They're facing each other through a screen door, neither in a hurry to leave. Over his shoulder, he says,
Hey, Tommy! Over here!
Tommy arrives at the front door in a rush and can't believe his eyes. Vanessa says,
Come on, guys. Give us some privacy here, okay? Nathan's in the shower, and we're not finished with our business. Who shall I tell him stop by?
She then realizes that in her haste, she forgot to remove the latex gloves. Red panties, aquamarine gloves. Neither can take his eyes off her breasts. One says,
Greg and Tommy. We're just sort of passing by.
Both are entranced by her nakedness and baffled by the gloves. What on earth has this gal been doing with our buddy?
I'll be happy to tell him, she says with a cute smile as she slowly closes the door.
Through the window, she watches as they back away, still slack-jawed and confused. They finally get to their truck, climb in, and start laughing as they leave the driveway. After they're gone, Vanessa fixes a glass of ice water and sits at the kitchen table for a few moments. She's rattled and ready for a meltdown, but cannot afford one. She's sick of the house and has serious doubts about the entire project. But she has to go on. I'm in the back of a cab headed for the airport when I see the call. I've spent the last 15 minutes imagining various scenes and conflicts inside Nathan's house, none of them with good endings. Are you okay? I ask.
Yes, just a couple of rednecks looking for Nathan. I got rid of them.
How?
I'll tell you later.
Did they see you?
Oh, yes. It's cool. We're fine. Where's the stuff?
Out back in the storage shed. I'll stay on the phone.
Okay.
Vanessa checks the driveway once more to make sure there are no more visitors, then hurries out the back door and to the storage shed. The dog is growling and barking frantically, and I can hear him clearly in Jamaica. I cannot make myself warn her about the snakes, so I silently pray that she does not encounter them. Digging through a grungy outbuilding is bad enough. Throw in the snakes and she might freak out and disappear. When she steps into the shed, she describes the interior. She says it's like an oven. I relay Nathan's instructions, and we sign off. She'll need both hands. She moves two empty paint thinner cans, kicks aside a burlap bag, pushes the Sears mower as far away as possible, lifts a sheet of plywood, and finds a rope handle. It's stuck, so she yanks it harder and harder until the door opens. There are no hinges, so the entire trap door bolts from the floor and falls against the wall. Under it, on the ground, as advertised, is a soiled bronze casket, no more than 4 feet in length. Vanessa gawks at it in horror, as if she has stumbled upon a crime scene and found some poor child's body. But there is no time for fear or second guessing, no time to ask, what in hell am I doing here? She tries to lift the casket, but it is too heavy. She finds the latch, twists, and half of the top lid opens slowly. Mercifully, there is no dead baby inside. Far from it. Vanessa pauses to study the collection of small wooden cigar boxes, all sealed with a band of silver duct tape, and for the most part stacked in rows. Sweat is dripping from her eyebrows, and she tries to swipe at it with a forearm. Carefully, she removes one of the boxes and steps outside under the shade of an oak. Glancing around, seeing no one, nothing but the dog who's tired of barking and growling, Vanessa peels off the tape, opens the box, and slowly removes a layer of wadded newspaper. Mini bars, little bricks, dominoes, an entire casket full of them. Millions upon millions. She removes one and examines it. A perfect rectangle, not quite a half inch thick, lined with a tiny border ridge that allows for precise stacking and storage. On the front side is stamped 10 ounces, and under that, 99.9%. And nothing else. No bank name, no indication of where it came from or who mined it. No registration number.
Using a prepaid credit card, I pay $300 for an Air Jamaica flight to San Juan, Puerto Rico. It leaves in an hour, so I find a bench near my gate and kill time, staring at my cell phone. Before long, it lights up and vibrates. Vanessa says, "He's not lying. Talk to me." "Love to, baby. We now own 18 cigar boxes filled with these gorgeous little gold mini bars. Haven't counted them all yet, but there must be at least 500. I take a deep breath and feel like crying. This project has been on the drawing board for over 2 years, and during most of that time, the odds of a successful outcome were at least 1,000 to 1. A series of loosely connected events had to fall perfectly into place. We're not yet at the finish line, but we are in the home stretch. I can smell the barn. Between 500 and 600, I say, according to our boy. He's earned the right to be trusted. Where are you? At the airport. I bought a ticket, made it through customs, and I'll board in an hour. So far, no problems. Where are you? I'm leaving this dump. I've loaded up the good stuff and put everything back in its place. The house is locked. Don't worry about the house. You'll never see it again. I know. I gave his dog a whole sack full of food. Maybe someone will check on him. Get away from that place. I'm leaving now. Just follow the plan, and I'll call when I can. Chapter 37. It's almost 11, Sunday morning, July 24th. A hot, clear day with little traffic around Radford. Vanessa wants to avoid another encounter with anyone who might see Nathan's pickup truck and get suspicious. She heads north on the interstate, past Roanoke, into the heart of the Shenandoah Valley, driving as cautiously as humanly possible, with the needle stuck on 70 miles per hour and every lane change properly telegraphed with a turn signal. She watches the rearview mirror because it's now such a habit, and she watches every other vehicle to avoid any chance of a collision. On the passenger's floorboard and on the seat next to her, there is literally a fortune in gold, a fortune in unmarked and untraceable ingots, freshly stolen from a thief who stole them from a crook who took them from a gang of thugs. How could she explain such a collection of precious metal to a nosy state trooper? She could not. So she drives as perfectly as possible as the 18-wheelers roar by in the left lane. She exits at a small town and drifts until she finds a cheap dollar store. The banner across the front windows advertises pre-back-to-school specials. She parks near the entrance and spreads a soiled blanket taken from Nathan's over the cigar boxes. She puts the Glock under a corner of the blanket next to her and analyzes the parking lot. It's virtually empty on a Sunday morning. Finally, she takes a deep breath, gets out, locks the truck, and hurries inside. In less than 10 minutes, Vanessa buys 10 kids' backpacks, all with a Desert Storm camouflage motif. She pays in cash and does not respond when the cashier quips, "Must have a lot of kids heading back to school." She shoves her purchases into the cab of the truck and heads back to the interstate. An hour later, she finds a truck stop near Staunton, Virginia, and parks next to the rigs. When she's certain that no one is watching, she begins to quickly stuff the cigar boxes into the backpacks, two of which are not used. She fills up the tank, eats lunch from a fast food drive-through, and kills time roaming up and down Interstate 81, as far north as Maryland and as far south as Roanoke. The hours drag by. She cannot park and leave the jackpot. It has to be guarded at all times. So she flows with the traffic while she waits on darkness. I'm pacing in a crowded and humid wing of the San Juan airport, waiting on a Delta flight to Atlanta. My ticket was purchased in the name of Malcolm Bannister, and his old passport worked just fine. It will expire in 4 months. The last time it was used, Dion and I escaped on a cheap cruise to the Bahamas. Another lifetime. I call Vanessa twice and we speak in code. Got the goods, packages are fine. She's moving around following the plan. If a spook somewhere is listening, then he's scratching his head. At 3:30, we finally board and then sit for an hour in the sweltering cabin as a howling storm pounds the airport and the pilots go mute. At least two babies are squalling behind me. As tempers rise, I close my eyes and try to nap, but I have deprived myself of sleep for so long, I have forgotten how to doze off. Instead, I think of Nathan Cooley and his hopeless situation, though I have little sympathy. I think of Vanessa and smile at her toughness under pressure. We are so close to the finish line, but there are still so many ways to fail. We have the gold, but can we keep it? I wake up as we lurch forward and begin rumbling down the runway. 2 hours later, we land in Atlanta. At passport control, I manage to avoid the counters manned by black customs agents and instead pick a beefy young white boy who seems to be bored and indifferent. He takes my passport, glances at a 9-year-old photo of Malcolm Bannister, quickly compares it to the revised face of Max Reed Baldwin, and sees nothing unusual. We all look the same. I am assuming customs has by now notified the FBI that I left the country 2 days earlier on a private jet bound for Jamaica. What I don't know is whether the FBI is still monitoring any possible movements by Malcolm Bannister. I'm betting they are not, and I want the FBI to think I'm still somewhere in the islands having a grand time. At any rate, I'm moving quickly. Since Malcolm no longer has a valid driver's license, Max rents a car at the Avis desk, and 45 minutes after landing in Atlanta, I'm leaving the city in a hurry. Near Roswell, Georgia, I stop at a Walmart and pay cash for 2 more prepaid cell phones. As I leave the store, I drop 2 old ones into a trash can. After dark, Vanessa parks the truck for good. She's been driving it for almost 12 hours and can't wait to get rid of it. For a moment, she sits behind the wheel, in a space next to her Honda Accord, and watches a commuter airliner taxi to the Roanoke terminal. It's a little after 9 on a Sunday night, and there appears to be no traffic. The parking lot is almost empty. She takes another deep breath and gets out. Working quickly while watching everything around her, she transfers the backpacks from Nathan's front seat into the trunk of her car. 8 backpacks, each seemingly heavier than the one before it. But she does not mind at all. She locks the truck, keeps the keys, and leaves the parking lot. If things go as planned, Nathan's truck will not be noticed for several days. When his friends realize he's missing, they will eventually notify the police, who will find the truck and start piecing together.